to the Classicist Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Senek, and the Classicist is Victor Davis Hanson, the Martin and Ilya Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And Victor, here we are essentially, if not literally, in autumn, and the public unrest that started back around Memorial Day with the death of George Floyd still going on in many cities around America. And in certain cities especially, we've seen these cloudbursts of violence and rioting and looting. And the range of reactions that we've seen to that have ranged from condemnation on the one side to, in a surprising number of cases, excuses or even remarkably justifications for the violence. But there's one particular line of argument that I want to start with because it gets us to a theme in some of your recent writing. There's a strain of riot apologia that argues, so what if these buildings get torched and things get broken along the way? That's what these companies have insurance for. And we can even set aside for a moment the misunderstanding of how insurance works that that represents. But it also represents a philosophical understanding of all of this as mutable. And the strain I see in your recent writing is the opposite, that there will be real and lasting material costs to what we're seeing. So make that case for us.
The BLM Antifa ideology is at odds with human nature. And the reason the United States works and most countries don't is it protects private property, the right to inheritance, and it sort of rewards, at least psychologically, the idea that whatever you create is yours and that that has positive attributes for citizenship. It makes you a custodian of property. You want to work and invest. You're not a renter or a peasant, in other words. But when they get this idea that all property, when they say, you know, burn down your SHIT or it's ours, give us back what we owe, then you're going against the very grain that allows them that leisure time and that apparent affluence, because they seem well-dressed and they have plenty of money and they're not out. And they don't steal, after all, rice and beans. They steal high-end goods. But if you don't have that trust, then people are not going to run the system as they do now. And what do I mean by that? Well, if you're going to burn down the Target in your inner city neighborhood and you're going to say, you know, you're a parasitical insect, then there's no reason why that person would want to build it again, because you're going to do the same thing again. And when the authorities don't punish criminality, they're going to say, you know what, why do I invest millions of dollars when they'll burn it down next year for another so-called incident or scandal? And then the authorities in Minneapolis or Seattle or Chicago or Kenosha, wherever they are, they're going to say, you know what, we're afraid of these people and maybe you deserved it, or it's just brick and mortar. So they're going to pull out, human nature being what it is. And then when you say insurance, well, we're going to loot your Gucci thing because it's just insurance, or we're going to loot this store. Well, the problem is insurance is based on actuarial tables, not life insurance properties. It's based on averages. And when they pay out a lot, then they don't distinguish between a guy who should be able to afford it and a person that will bankrupt. It's like this fire that we're going through in California. When some people choose in the government not to harvest trees and to let them be the dead there for 6 years, or other homeowners won't remove dead trees, or they insist on having picturesque wood shingles, and they say, well, the insurance will cover it. Well, yeah, they'll cover it one time, but either they'll get out of the business if their losses exceed profits, or the premiums will be so high that people with less resources won't be able to afford it. So what I'm getting at is it looks very romantic for an inner city guy or an Antifa to yell and scream at the man and say, you got insurance. But this system is based on an insidious set of relationships and understandings that allows people to take risk with capital that otherwise they don't have to take it if they don't want to. And when the odds are against them, that is a likelihood it'll be burned down, whether it's an insurance company or a chain store, they just won't come back. And I think we're already going to see that.
There are some recent poll numbers out from Gallup, which has been doing polling on race relations for a long time. And they're very interesting. So first, the background on this. For the first decade and change of the 21st century, the trend lines here are pretty consistent. Generally, a little over two-thirds of whites thought that race relations were good, a little under two-thirds of blacks, more variability on the black side. There seems to be more sensitivity to negative developments there. But this all starts to nosedive around the time of Ferguson and the Michael Brown situation back in 2014. And it's continued to plummet. In the most recent data, it's less than half of whites that think the situation is good, barely more than a third of blacks. So on the one hand, that seems obvious because we've had this string of high-profile media cases that have driven the Black Lives Matter movement. On the other, however, it's hard to look at the progress this country has made on race relations just within living memory and see grounds for pessimism at the depths necessary to foment what feels, in some senses, like a quasi-revolutionary fervor. So how do you account for the intensity of sentiment? Because the fire feels like it's burning really hot at the moment.
Well, I think in 2017 and 18 and 19, because of the low unemployment and the real efforts to reindustrialize the Midwest and things like that in our major cities, that things were getting much better. But how do I account for the rise? It's kind of like, I think, maybe the Middle East electrical engineering syndrome. So if you go to the West Bank or you go to Iraq or Kuwait, the only people you meet are electrical engineers. And they're usually people that went and borrowed money at all of these tech schools that proliferate throughout the Middle East, and they get a degree. And then they think they're westernized and they're going to get, and they, you know, they're in a university situation, they're going to get these wonderful big jobs. And there's an oversupply of qualified people. And so their expectations have risen faster than reality. So had they not gone there, they would have thought things are getting better. But once they get a degree, they think things should be really good. And I think that's happened in terms of, we only had 9 people. It depends on how you look at the data, 9 to 19. I shouldn't say only, that's tragic, but African-Americans killed that were unarmed by police, and a fraction of what we used to have. If you look at the number of African-American college educated, if you look at the per capita income, if you look at the gap between white and black unemployment, it was all positive. But I think what happened is, as it does with everybody, it suggested we're right on the cusp of utopia. And so then when you don't quite get there, in counterfactual, illogical fashion, people are angrier than they went when they were really asymmetrical in the sense of earning potential and economic parity. That's one. The other is that it's a tragedy because the African-American population is about 12%, and it's now mouthing, its leaderships are enunciating, mouthing, voicing, echo, whatever term we want to say it. They are, they're echoing what people in the segregated period did. So you get a letter from a university, you get an Oscar, and they'll say, we want a black space. Or even BLM is now telling in Rochester, we want our own black people separated by race. Or we want a safe black theme house. Or we want to be able to pick our dorm. And so there's going to be a lot of people on the liberal side who, I don't want to say this too provocatively, but I think they were not comfortable, white, wealthy liberals living with the other. So their kids were in private school. They didn't associate with middle class or lower class blacks. And then they virtue signaled as a psychological compensation. They said, well, you know, all these whites have white privilege, these yokels and deplorables and basket of irredeemables. But I think what's going to happen, they're going to say, well, we reached out, and now we're not going to reach out anymore because they don't want us around. And there are going to be a lot of people who say that, and it's going to be one of the worst things for the black community, because I think most African-Americans don't want to segregate by race. I think their elite might do, but even they are confused about it. But that if they keep it up, then it's not going to be positive. And you can see it with sports. 75-76% of the NFL and NBA are African American, and the majority of their audience is not. And yet they're saying, this is a racist country. We're not going to stand for their flag. We're not going to do this. And at some point, people are going to say, you know what? You're right. You've got a perfect right to say that you don't want to stand, and don't stand. But we're just not going to participate. We're not going to watch it anymore. And I don't think, given their lifestyles and salaries, that they're going to have the revenue. And so that's a danger. What I'm getting at in a historical sense is I don't know historically very many societies where a small minority of the population decides to re-tribalize and identify solely by race and then make complaints against the majority, historical complaints, some very valid, but nevertheless, carry them into the present from the past and say, you know what, we demand this and we demand this and we're going to keep separate from you. I can't think that it's been a winning solution or a winning strategy. I'm not talking about whether it's good or not. I'm just saying that you don't see it with Christian minorities under the Ottoman Empire. You don't see it with Armenians that were living in Turkey. You don't see it today with a few Greeks that are living in Turkey. You don't see it with any population that's in a minority wanting to self-segregate and then making accusations as the reason that they want to. I just don't think it's not a good strategy. And I thought we learned that in the 60s where the Black Panthers sort of hijacked Martin Luther King's legacy and they sort of imploded the whole civil rights movement. And then suddenly in the 1990s, nobody was talking about, you know, Huey Newton as they had rediscovered Martin Luther King. So I don't think that in the Black community, it'll be considered a lasting winning strategy.
On a related note to that, you wrote in a recent piece at American Greatness that, I'm quoting you here, our collective future of nationalized tribalism will become what always results when citizens identify by superficial appearance or shared religion. Just go to Lebanon, the Balkans, or Iraq to see what's in store firsthand. So that's a theme that we've talked about on the show before, how easy it is to slip into factionalism because of the tribal temptation. And it strikes me that in some ways, the most interesting question there is not how likely is America to fall into that, but why haven't we already fallen into it in the past? If you were to look at the historical record pre-United States, and you were to tell someone from that era that a multiracial, multiethnic, multireligious nation would hold things together for as long as we have, a lot of people would probably think that you were crazy. So what explains how we've been able to hold it together up to this point? And to what degree do you think we can retain it?
Yeah, I think it's a lot of ignorance of history. If you go back and read the liberal, not the conservative Tory or Whig or whatever, but you read the Arthur Schlesinger Jr. tradition of the Jacksonian age or the American Revolution or Civil War period, it was pretty much that this was a great experience. Unlike the Spanish Empire, people were allowed to go into British-held North America that were either, they didn't have to be just Protestant. There were few of them at the beginning, but there were Catholics allowed. And then that spirit of ecumenicalism pervaded, and it was the logical, you know, logical consequences of the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, that it would be if all men are created equal and North America is wide open. And obviously, people are going to eventually come who don't resemble superficially the founders, and that happened. And when you have a country that committed suicide, 700,000 killed over the question of slavery, and people who had never met a Black person in their entire life, say in rural Michigan in 1864, were marching through Georgia singing battle hymn of the Republic. This country was different, and it was always at odds to try to live up to its exalted rhetoric, human being just mere humans. So to come go back and say, wow, this country has all of these sins and these culpabilities and pathologies, and it's just a rewriting of history or an ignorance of history. And they don't quite understand what we were trying to do. We were trying to do something very dangerous in history, and that is judge people on the content of their character, not the color of their skin. And now we have all of these different groups due to changing demographies and attitudes and stuff. And that's good, but it's still a very dangerous and volatile situation. And if you want to identify by tribe, it's always predicated on the idea that there is a white oppressor that did all these bad things in 1776 or 1820 or 1850 or 1960. And therefore, all of these white people are monolithic. And they're not. And I'm just returning from rural Michigan. If you want to see poverty, I suggest somebody go down to the Michigan-Ohio border and go to a Walmart. That is poverty, much more than here in mostly Mexican-American California. What I'm getting at is that there's only so much things you can say to a working-class white person that was born in 1980 and 1990 well after the civil rights movement in the age of affirmative action. Keep calling him a racist, racist, racist. Keep saying he has privilege, privilege. Keep saying he's fragile, fragile, when he has nothing. And you're begging him to do what you're doing. You're begging him to identify by his superficial tribal appearance. If you do that, it's not a very good, it's not a wise idea. And I can see it already happening. I see it all the time. And it's not, I think people are going to regret it, because I have a lot of Mexican-American friends and here in Selma, and they do not like it. And they're saying, you know, we have a lot more in common with America than we do with people coming across the border in Oaxaca. What's happening, I don't want to identify by who I am. So it's something that was created among the elites in the university and the youth culture imbibed it, but they have no idea historically what they're doing. And it's going to end badly if we go down that road.
There's an obvious discomfort amongst some Democrats. It's made things tough for Joe Biden on some fronts, that comes from trying to distance themselves from the rioting and the looting and the violence while still attempting to show their sympathy for the underlying causes for which the protests are ostensibly undertaken. It's a bit of a high wire act. What conclusions have you drawn from the way that the Democrats in general and Joe Biden in particular have handled this thus far?
Well, that was going to be a logical consequence of the whole Biden phenomenon. We knew to anticipate it once the rioting and looting started. By that, I mean, good old Joe Biden from Scranton was not up to being a candidate. He lost in Iowa and New Hampshire. And he was out of tune with this Bernie Sanders, AOC, Elizabeth Warren party. And people, you know, Cory Booker basically said he was senile, and Kamala Harris basically said he was a racist, and he was in fourth place. And then Michael Bloomberg, the savior of the moderate wing, supposedly the new Democratic Party, spent $1 billion and got nothing. And so then it was Sanders and socialism or what? And so they resurrected, reinflated Biden. And he had to come to peace with Bernie Sanders and the hard left wing, and he had to renounce. And we saw those humiliations he did with Harris in some of the debates. But he had to renounce his former good old Joe from Scranton, and he had to incorporate those people. And then it was just a ticking time bomb. By that I meant we just want to look at issue after issue. I don't want to ever have fracking. We're going to phase out fossil fuel. Oh, but by the way, I need to win some of rural Pennsylvania, because I'm not going to rack up Philadelphia and Pittsburgh like Obama did. So I never said I was against fracking. Oh, I want to defund the police, but I need to split or get 55% of the suburban soccer mom vote in Minneapolis and you know, Des Moines. And I can't offend that group. So I kind of don't want to defund the police. And I think reparations is a good idea, but I don't think it's so. That's what he does. And that's part of, that kind of fuels the larger strategy that he sits in his basement now, and it's pretty much a Wizard of Oz candidacy. I wrote about that today, that he's got this image, and then there's somebody behind the screen with gears and levers, and by that I mean there's a hidden teleprompter. We saw that accidentally appear the other day. He reads the talking points. He'll say, end of quotation. Or he'll look around and say, where is it? I don't know who my staff has. Or bring it closer. And you get the impression that the questions are scripted, the answers are scripted. When he goes out to barnstorm in Michigan, he has sort of like a drive-in movie situation where people are social distancing in cars, or he stays from the balcony of a plane. And so the strategy is basically, let's not talk about what Joe Biden believes in versus what Donald Trump's agenda is, because that agenda was repudiated in the Democratic primary. Nobody wanted the New Green Deal or Medicare for everybody or open borders or reparations, but he had to sign on to that minority wing to get nominated. And now it's a smelly albatross around his neck. And so that's a contradiction. He's not cognitively able to run a traditional campaign, so they've got to repackage him or recalibrate him or pump him up or something. That explains how he does it. And then he can't talk about, you know, anything other. He can't really talk about the issues, because he was going to lose in a landslide election had it been held in February. The economy was good. The foreign policy was fine. We were the world's largest gas and oil. There was a lot of good things that Trump admittedly his even his enemies conceded. But so what is it now? It's Joe Biden not talking about the issue, trying to square the circle of being a Democratic socialist and running against COVID and running against the police or Donald Trump causing the rioting. And how that works out is I think that he had about a 12-point lead, 10-point lead, and he's bleeding. I don't know whether it's a quarter point a day or a third of a point, but it's steady. And now he's nearing, depending on which polls, he's nearing 5%. That lead is down to 5%. If you look at the non-traditional polls in some of the states, Rasmussen, Emerson, Zogby, Trafalgar, he's almost even in some states. And so at some point, that hemorrhaging is going to stop and this strategy will prove successful or it won't. And if it keeps hemorrhaging into another 2 weeks and Donald Trump is even or takes a lead, then I don't know what they're going to do. I don't know whether he's going to renounce the AOC agenda or I don't know whether he's going to take a risk and go out there and get mixed with a crowd. But he's going to have to do something because just sitting behind there and being a Wizard of Oz image on a screen and having his surrogates attack Donald Trump on COVID was really smart in May and April, May, June, July, but I don't think it's so smart in October, so we'll see. The race is tightening. It's just a question of is enough time for Trump to close the margin.
My final question for you, the year that is being invoked most often as a parallel for 2020 is 1968, when you also had this, you know, widespread sense of unrest in America. And there are certainly other periods in American history we'd probably be hearing more about if media types weren't so in the grips of a recency bias. But if 1968 felt like utter chaos, Americans living back then might have been surprised if they could have seen what, for instance, the 1980s and 1990s looked like, that it wasn't just this long period of unmitigated decline that followed. So we have to stipulate, as they say in investing circles, that past performance is no guarantee of future results. But when we look at a moment like today, which seems so volatile, how do we decipher, if we even can, if what we're seeing is a cyclical phenomenon that will eventually abate, or if this is part of a longer-term decline?
No, I think it'll debate. Whether it's part, it'll be peaks and valleys and slow declines, another question. But this was a phenomenon. We don't like to talk about it because the right wants to see that, rightly so, that these are expressions of deep-seated, long-held pathologies. And the left wants to say these are the results of principled opposition to a racist society. But each side should concede. Had we not had this fear of this weird, mysterious vampire-like virus, paranoia about it, had we not had the first quarantine in history, had we not self-induced a recession, we've never done that. There was no banking crisis. There was no real estate crash. There was no lack of panic on the stock market. There was no foreign collapse of a bank. This was a self-induced recession. And then we've never had, so you add all that, and then you put people out on the streets, and, you know, empirically, you look at George Floyd and the other two shootings, and they have a pattern that an African-American was rough-handled. In one case of George Floyd, probably contributed to his death. We don't know the autopsy, how that'll be interpreted by a jury. But we had a person who was committing a crime or clearly wanted in the act of a crime or wanted on a warrant for pretty serious felonies, and then was mostly attacked. Disobeyed the police or resisted the police or physically attacked the police, and a death ensued. And in normal times, that would have been maybe a day of rioting, but or even Baltimore-like incident, but not this. So I think it was the idea that people were cooped up, they were terrified of the virus, they were terrified of the economy, and that intent, that was a force multiplier. And as we start to move on, I think those force multipliers will start mitigating. There's one other thing that was not like the 1960s. When you went into those Democratic cities, they were SOBs like Rizzo in Philadelphia or Daley in Chicago or, you know, Sam Yorty in L.A. or whatever you want to call them, but they were Democrats and they were hard-nosed people and they wanted law and order. So they were inviting in federal troops. And Democratic presidents like LBJ were happy to accede to their wishes. We've never had a situation where the 60s generation has come of age, and they're in their 60s and 70s and 80s. And this is almost a surrogate reliving of their youth. By that, I mean the establishment and the corporate establishment, the media establishment, the blue state attorney generals, mayors, governors. They're all either on the side openly of the demonstrations and writing and looting, or at least they're contextualizing. And that makes it different. And it's also holistic. In the 60s, everybody still watched the Super Bowl. Even hippies did. And in the 60s, everybody, straight parents went and saw, you know, Coming Home with John Voight or Easy Rider. There was that cross-cultural fertilization. This is a polarized situation where we didn't have anything like MSNBC or CNN. We did not have anything like LeBron James, Colin Kaepernick, or this politicalization of every aspect of our lives. We didn't have people in the 60s. They were rioting everything, but they were not going into McDonald's and overthrowing tables and chairs and attacking people based on their race. It just didn't happen. So this is a little bit different. This is more of a malice phenomenon.
You've been listening to the Classicist Podcast with Victor Davis Hanson. Remember, you can read all of Victor's work at victorhanson.com, and he's on Twitter at VDHanson. And if you enjoy the show, please rate it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For Victor Davis Hanson, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org. Thank you.